Good evening. This is Dean Becker. Our producer tonight is Steve Nolan. Our guest for the evening will be Kevin Zeis of Common Sense for Drug Policy, who will tell us of the medical marijuana events of this past week, and Professor David Duncan of Brown University, who will fill us in on how treatment is mostly a scam and it's the government's hoped for secondary phase of the drug war inquisition. But first, I want to read a couple of quick editorials. What if Osama bin Laden sent squads of armed men into U.S. cities to attack medical facilities? What if those terror squads stormed clinics, stole confidential medical records, and literally took medicine from the sick and dying? Well, that is precisely what the Drug Enforcement Administration is doing in California. The DEA and the White House want the public to believe that drugs are inherently connected with terrorism, and that anyone who uses illegal drugs supports terrorists. In fact, it is the war on drugs that promotes terrorism, and the DEA and its law enforcement allies regularly commit terrorist acts. They take medicine from the seriously ill, jail their caregivers, and murder unarmed people with no evidence and no trial. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this, I would advise you to please go to the Marijuana Policy Project website. That's at www.mpp.org. That's www.mpp.org. Now, I'm very pleased to announce that we now have online our first guest, a gentleman I greatly admire for his perseverance and his attitude and his follow-through, Kevin Zeis. Are you there, sir? Kevin?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
Well, good evening, sir. It's good to have you with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
Yes, sir. I know it's been a very eventful week, clear across the nation from Sacramento to Washington, D.C. Could you tell us what you observed in Sacramento this week?
Yeah, well, in Sacramento, we had a large rally in reaction to the DEA's attacks on medical marijuana caregivers and patients in California. Hundreds of people from across the state, nearly 1,000 probably, from across the state, patients, their caregivers, students, some politicians, and other people concerned with this issue, showed up in Sacramento, the capital of California, to protest the DEA's actions and to urge state officials of California to protect them from the attack of John Ashcroft's Justice Department. And after meeting at the Capitol building and holding a rally there that was co-sponsored by Senator John Vasconcellos, a long-term ally and a very senior senator in California, we had a procession that went down to the Federal Building, and there was a demonstration at the Federal Building where 29 people blocked the entrance to the Federal Building in a symbolic effort to show their resistance to federal enforcement, overzealous enforcement of the medical marijuana laws. And these 29 people refused to move. They locked arms. One was in a wheelchair, and the federal officials came and arrested them. And it was quite a moment. There was a lot of angry people in the crowd. There were probably took over an hour for these arrests to occur. It was a slow process, and I think there was a real strong symbol of the strength of the California medical marijuana movement, their willingness to stand up against the federal government. So it's the beginning of a campaign, and I think if we pursue this aggressively, I think we'll succeed, and it'll be the end of the federal government's war on medical marijuana.
I sincerely believe you're right. I think it will take the perseverance you speak of. The scene you described is fairly reminiscent of an event that occurred in June, I believe, with you and was it 9 other people at the Justice Building in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, well, a group of us and a lot of reformers across the country, in fact, have kind of signed up to work with a group called the Americans for Safe Access. And it's a group that's... whenever there's a medical marijuana bust, by the federal government, they'll organize nationwide demonstrations. And on June 6th, we had demonstrations in over 50 cities, and we did one in Washington, D.C. to kind of start the day off. And our focus was John Ashcroft and the Department of Justice, and we chained ourselves the front doors of the Department of Justice and refused to unchain ourselves, and federal enforcement came and arrested us all, 10 of us. And then across the country that day, there were demonstrations everywhere. And by the way, just this last week when we had the Sacramento demonstration, again, there were demonstrations in a number of cities. Cause
we had one here in Kevin at the federal building, federal courthouse downtown. We had one Sunday evening, a candlelight vigil. And then Monday we had Republicans in suits, if you will, standing out front describing the horrors being inflicted by the DEA.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's the kind of activism we need to make this point. I mean, I think if every time the federal government raids a medical marijuana club, people across the country block federal buildings, they'll start to get the message that people are serious. It's not going to be worth the effort. I mean, you know, we're talking about something here that 73% of the American public supports, and we've never lost an election, statewide election, on medical marijuana in California, where we had this, where the biggest onslaught seems to be occurring. 56% of the public have voted for medical marijuana in 1996. Some of the raids the DEA is pursuing now are really not the normal type of thing that's in federal jurisdiction. They're small plants. I mean, for example, just earlier this week, they raided a dispensary in San Diego, 20 plants,
yeah.
Six patients. Three of the patients have cancer, three are older women who have emotional problems, depression and such, and that is not the normal federal raid, especially in San Diego, a border city, where we have real law enforcement problems at the border there. To be wasting federal resources on something that is necessary for six patients, something that's been voted for statewide, something that the San Diego City has been coming up with rules on, and this is well under the right rules for six patients. Something that the federal government would officially not prosecute. In fact, the federal government has guidelines that say it won't prosecute under 100 plants. I mean, those are guidelines, so they can ignore them because they're not law. But that's the typical standard of history. So for the federal government going after this kind of club, and the week before that, they went after a hospice up in Santa Cruz. And up there, this is a hospice that didn't sell pot. It gave it away.
Right.
And 85% of the people who go to this hospice were terminally ill.
Kevin, if I may interrupt, if I'm not mistaken, 1/6 of the members of that club have died this year.
Exactly.
And it's just totally outrageous.
And this is something that was voted for by the citizens of San Francisco. And I'll tell you, in San Francisco, they're going to be voting on a citywide vote that would encourage the city to grow marijuana for its patients. And I'll tell you, that's going to pass by 2-1 or more. And so the city's going to have a strong support from the voters telling them to go ahead and grow marijuana so that the serious people can get it. So we'll have an interesting conflict then when the city grows marijuana medicine and the federal government has to try and enforce the law again. It'll be the government versus government. And we had that, by the way, in Santa Cruz last week. After that hospice was raided, the city of Santa Cruz allowed marijuana to be given away at the city hall with the current mayor, almost all the city council, and two former mayors looking on. So this battle is definitely escalating, and it's sharpening the issue.
Kevin, we're going to bring in David Duncan here in just a moment.
I
was wondering if you could tell us about your associate, Doug McVeigh, and what they did in Washington.
Well, as I said, these demonstrations that you guys were involved in last week in Houston, we were involved in Sacramento, they happened in a number of cities across the country, and there was a small demonstration in Washington, D.C., in solidarity with Sacramento. About 30 reform activists were out in front of the White House, and two of them, my colleague, Doug McVeigh, who is one of the top researchers in the movement, he puts together Drug War Facts, which your listeners can check out on www.drugwarfacts.org, and which is a great resource for the movement. But
it's a fantastic piece of work, Kevin. It really is.
That's a major effort, and he does a fantastic job getting the information for the movement. But he also has some emotion in this. I mean, he's been working in this field for a long time. He knows some of the people in California, Oregon, other states that are involved in the medical marijuana movement. These friends of his are facing potentially 10 to 15 years in jail if they get arrested by the federal government because they're dispensing marijuana to hundreds of seriously ill patients. And so in support of them and concern for them, he decided that he's going to take it a step further, and He and one other activist chained themselves to the White House fence. The other activist was Chuck Thomas, who is the Unitarian Universalist for drug policy reform. Unitarians in the last year, this current year, have issued a statement of conscience that calls an end to the drug war. So he was acting on behalf of that group. So I see more and more activists are willing to stand up to the outrageousness of the federal government. The more extreme they get, the stronger we're going to get. And they don't realize, but their efforts are actually going to escalate the end of the drug war.
I agree. Okay, we're going to bring in David here in just a second. Kevin, I do want to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope after we bring David in, you can hang around for just a little while, maybe
sure,
for a question
that.
Or two. And
yeah,
let's see if we can get David online now.
All right.
Hello, David.
Hello, Dean.
Good evening, Professor Duncan. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
Yes, sir. Were you able to hear our discussion with Kevin?
I was able to hear the last part of it.
Okay. I was wondering if I could get your take. What is your perception of these DEA raids? Is this the dying gasp of the drug warriors?
I think it very well could be. I think that the drug war relies very strongly on demonizing certain drugs, on making them seem so terrible that there's no choice but to outlaw them. And medical marijuana, they see as being a major threat to that. If we show something that marijuana is good for, then we have cut into their demonization. And so they are willing to take any extreme measure and to ignore entirely any limits of the federal government, any concept of democracy in order to maintain the hold on that demonization. I think that in the end it may very well be the Achilles heel of the whole prohibition.
Yeah, David, you know, today I saw an editorial from a Daytona Beach, Florida paper about, I guess the drug czar, John Walters, had been through Florida, his anti-marijuana program, and the Daytona Beach editorial page came out and just, you know, flat out called him a liar and an exaggerator and that his extremism showed why the drug war was a failure. And they specifically focused on, part of their discussion on medical marijuana. I mean, the refusal to accept that marijuana has medical value, despite evidence that's pretty strong, even though the federal government's tried to prevent research that has been done has been pretty positive. It's just outrageous that they let people suffer. It's just outrageous.
I think it clearly shows that the reasons behind the drug war are not anything humane or not protecting the public or serving the public interest.
You know, it's funny you put it that way, because I remember when I was first getting involved in this issue back when I was in law school back in the late 1970s, I worked on a medical marijuana case for Normal in those days and also worked on a case trying to stop herbicide spraying in Mexico. And as I was walking back to law school, I was thinking about this issue and kind of had one of those moments where you see the path in front of you more clearly. And you hear the government saying they're doing this to protect your health, and they're poisoning the environment with paraquat. They're poisoning marijuana that people are going to smoke to make it more dangerous, and they're denying medicine to the seriously ill. And they say they're doing it for your health. That was a moment that got me active. I remember making that choice. It was actually that exact point you just said was the obvious falsehood of their statement. So I think the escalation of this battle is letting the public see that falsehood, you know, and that hypocrisy. And hopefully other people will start to make this choice as well.
If I may interrupt, I saw an article, Fox News, that's not the biggest network in the world, I suppose, but they did have a statement came out the other day that basically said the aim of the traveling museum the DEA put together, and they said the aim was to stain the hands of the growing decriminalization movement with the blood of September 11th victims. It's shameless, exploitative, and not even remotely accurate.
Well, that's what I find, it's kind of funny, because what they're actually doing is they're showing the stained hands of prohibition.
Exactly.
It's not drugs that fund terrorism. It's drug profits from the illegality of drugs. I mean, the U.S. is the heaviest drug-using country in history. I mean, Prozac and Viagra for adults, Ritalin for our kids, caffeine at the airport and everywhere else on every other block, nicotine in candy stores, alcohol, in supermarkets. We are the heaviest drug-using culture in the history, but it's not those drugs that fund terrorism. It's a small number of drugs that are made illegal. Some are safer than the legal ones, but these small number of drugs that are made illegal, and it's the profits from illegality. So what they're really doing, and I hope we can get the public to see through their charade, what they're really doing is showing the blood on the hands of prohibition, because that's what's funding terrorism.
Exactly.
Yes, I watched the other night one of their new ads. This is the bag of pot that Stacy bought.
Right.
That traces it back to the little girl shot by the dealer or the supplier. I thought, you know, that could be one of our spots, too. It just needs to take the one step further. This is the law against marijuana that made all of this happen.
And what's good about them, and so, you know, sometimes when you're doing trying to persuade somebody, it's better to let them draw their own conclusions. And so that's what I mean, that this could end up backfiring on them, because the public may be smart enough to realize that you can make that same spot during alcohol prohibition. This is the beer that Stacy bought. This is the dealer she bought from, and this is the guy the dealer killed. I mean, Chicago was the murder capital of the world during alcohol prohibition, and the U.S. Is facing those same kind of problems today because of drug prohibition, as is Colombia and as is other parts of the world. But it's drug prohibition, not the drugs, that's driving the violence.
I'm astounded that John Walters has gone back to the original reefer madness, that pot is addicting and leads to criminality and death. I mean, that's a... they're recycling. They have no ammunition.
And this doesn't pass a straight face test. I'm telling you, when newspapers in Florida are editorializing against the drug czar's reefer madness when he leaves town, he comes through town, spouts of reefer madness, and the newspaper writes an editorial saying, God, the guy's not believable. He's just out of touch.
I want to alert our listeners that tonight's guests are Kevin Zeese of Common Sense for Drug Policy, Professor David Duncan of Brown University. You are listening to Cultural Baggage on 90.1 KPFT Houston or on the web at kpft.org. Our phone number here, we want you to call in here in just a moment, 713-526-5738. Kevin, I want to ask you one other question. We've talked before about starting the needle exchange program here in Houston, and I admit to being, I don't know, I won't say overworked, but I haven't accomplished it yet, and I am still working on it, and I want you to know that. Are there other cities that have these similar problems to Houston, or are we standing alone as the great... blindfolded look at this situation?
Houston is definitely one of the top 10 cities. It's one of the few that doesn't have a needle exchange, you know, but actually the other one that doesn't is San Antonio, which is also in Texas, as far as I know, doesn't have one. Both Austin and Dallas do, and there's over 120 needle exchanges across the country. So a lot of cities have these, and they vary, you know, they vary from outright legal to ignored and illegal to totally underground. And, you know, there's a range of these, but there's one thing that was sure, that needle exchange does work and does not do harm. In other words, it reduces the spread of HIV without increasing drug use. And in fact, what many cities find is that more people want to get into treatment when they when the needle exchange opens up, because they start to take people who use drugs start to take control of life, start to choose to protect their health. And when they choose to use a clean needle, that's often the first step to making other choices to create a safer lifestyle. So not only does it not increase drug use, it leads to treatment, and it certainly decreases HIV. And that saves the public money, because our public health system is a very costly one, and it's a very expensive to treat a full-blown AIDS patient. Some estimates up to $100,000 a year. Full-blown AIDS patient is expensive, but, you know, a needle costs under a dime. And so we can prevent the spread of HIV, we can reduce drug use, and we can also save money doing it. So it's a totally stupid, shoot ourselves in the foot kind of a approach not to have needle exchange programs.
In Rhode Island, we found that very soon after our needle exchange opened, it became the single largest source of referral into treatment.
Exactly.
More people coming into treatment through the needle exchange than through any other source that referred people to treatment programs.
Exactly right. So it actually reduced drug use. When you get somebody in a treatment program, One doesn't reduce drug use, but treatment's the most effective way to reduce crime related to drugs. It reduces drug dealing because the way that heavy drug users support their habit is by dealing drugs. So you stop the spread of the drug problem, and it reduces criminal justice costs. People who don't get stop using drugs don't get caught using drugs and don't get wrapped up in the criminal justice system. And even the simplest marijuana arrest will cost a police officer a half a day of his time to usher through the initial steps of the criminal justice system just for that first day of arrest. Then you got the whole court system. You got the defense lawyer. You got the prosecutor. You got the judges. You got the court personnel. You have the probation office. You have the pretrial services. You may have incarceration. So treatment saves crimes. It reduces crime, reduces drug dealing, reduces criminal justice costs, reduces health care costs, stops the spread of HIV by 50%, and does not increase drug use. I don't know why people are opposed to that. I don't understand why someone would look at the facts, and you know, I guess the misconception is it sends the wrong message, but I don't think needles draw people to drug use.
Certainly not. I'm reminded of a story, an ongoing story here in Houston. Tom Marshall, the great columnist, followed
this. He was a great columnist, by the way. Houston's lucky to have him.
Yes, you betcha. And he followed the story of this young lady, who bought half of a $10 rock of cocaine, and how she was arrested because the other person was an informant, bought the other $5 worth. She was arrested, held in jail for months on end, how many trials and psychiatrists and doctors, and he listed, you know, the dozens of people involved in this case and the amount of time wasted over a $5 rock of cocaine, and how did the county benefit from this when eventually she was declared mentally incompetent and, sent to a hospital.
I don't, the basic justification of the criminal justice system doesn't make much sense to me in the drug scene. I mean, you have a choice. Either someone is a problem drug user, an addict, or someone who's an occasional user and drug use is not a problem. The person who's an occasional user and drug use is not a problem, what does resting them clean in jail do? It makes them into a person with other problems in life, probably lose their job, probably not able to pay their mortgage, may have their kids taken away, may have bankruptcies around the corner, food stamps, welfare, all that's down the line. Once that arrest comes in, it can really increase the chances of that kind of thing happening. So what does it do for the person who's pretty much living life well, but using drugs occasionally? Then for the addict, who goes to prison and doesn't get drug treatment. We don't provide treatment. What does it accomplish to incarcerate someone who's an addict? I mean, it doesn't accomplish anything. So for the addict or the non-abusive user, prison makes no sense. It doesn't work.
No.
Who's it good for?
Profits for the prison builders. That's the only thing I can come up with.
Well, unfortunately, there is a lot of that. There is a lot of self-interest, and that is distressing. And and people also see other impacts. For example, it's a way to control blacks. We arrest very disproportionately African American men, especially, but also women. Seven times as many white drug users and dealers in this country, and yet two-thirds of those incarcerated are black and 20% are Latino. So almost 80% are black or brown, even though seven times as many white drug users. So there's other maybe nefarious reasons why the drug war continues, but it certainly doesn't make any sense when you look at it as far as preventing drug use or treating drug use or dealing with occasional drug users. It doesn't accomplish anything for any of those people.
Well, I think the developing situation in Tulia, Texas, is right up front with that scenario you described.
Your attorney general is shameful for the way he has handled that situation. You know, first he gives an award, top cop of the year, to the undercover, the really unreliable and dishonest undercover cop who made those busts, and then 3 years later, 2 months before the election, he decides to start an investigation of whether or not there was civil rights violations or other laws violated, and Texas laws violated. It is disgusting the way he has handled that, and I think just that alone deserves people should not vote for him just for the way he's handled that one case. It shows the man has no sense of justice and really is not someone who should be a political leader.
Kevin, I hope you'll hang around just a couple more minutes. We're getting some callers.
Sure.
And I want to remind the listeners out here that we are speaking with Kevin Zeese of Common Sense for Drug Policy and Professor David Duncan of Brown University. This is Cultural Baggage. Our phone number here, 713-526-5738. Let's see, John, somewhere in America, he has a question for us. Can you hear us, John?
Yes. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Just observing the situation again, it just seems like prohibition has slowly destroyed our freedom, and our leaders, weren't satisfied, and they took advantage after 9/11 and passed a bunch of laws that sent our freedoms even more pell-mell down the tubes, and now they're complaining that drug users are collaborators with terrorists. With another war, more possibilities for stealth legislation, and all of a sudden, we have 20 million plus marijuana consumers pursued as terrorists. This is a scenario I see very close. What do you think?
Well, you know, did you want to say something, David?
Yeah, in the wake of 9/11, the Republicans passed a whole bunch of legislation that wasn't caught up in response to the terrorism situation or the incidents in New York at all. It was a laundry list of things they'd been trying to get passed for years.
Right.
Most of it things that they had previously justified as being things to use in the drug war. Now they passed them as anti-terrorism. But I think you're going to see them used much more against political dissent and against drug users than you are against terrorists. Because terrorists are a whole lot harder to find and a whole lot more dangerous to deal with. And law enforcement has always gone for the easier targets whenever it could. I think also that the whole cynical thing of trying to blame it on, terrorism is somehow the result of kids buying marijuana has been a very useful tool for them, but that it's terribly cynical. Not too long before the attack on the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon, the United States government was praising Afghanistan for its efforts against drugs. The Taliban government was probably the most anti-drug government that that Afghanistan had ever had, and opium production is now at an all-time high since the U.S. Took the Taliban out of operation. Osama bin Laden is as strong an anti-drug person as John Walters is any day. He's extremely strong against it. He's a believer in spiritual purity, in his view of that thing. And it's really very hypocritical what is being done, but it serves a political purpose. And that's very much the whole history of the whole drug war. It has always served political purposes that had nothing to do with protecting the public against drugs.
Let me add a couple points to that. Dave makes a lot of good points, but let me add a couple more to it. First, I think, the drug terrorism link serves a couple of purposes for the drug warriors. First, it ties the less popular drug war to the more popular terrorism war, and that'll help them with their budget. When it comes to budget time in Washington, D.C., they'll be able to argue that the drug war is part of the security state and terrorism war and therefore give us more money. That's all they need. They spent $500 billion since 1980, and heroin and cocaine are cheaper and more pure than ever before, but they'll ask for more money, of course. And then the second thing it does, it isolates drug users further. It'll push them further and further away from mainstream society, from mainstream culture, makes them less likely to get social services or health care, and to make that worse. And finally, I think the caller's point is right. If they're successful in their stigmatizing drug users as part of the terrorism problem, it does provide an avenue for much more aggressive enforcement against a very high percentage of our population. So it's a scary foundation that they're laying here.
The only bright side I see is that for decades, 20 million plus, people, you get a different estimates, but 20 million plus people have been intimidated into silence. And if there comes a point where most of those people are suddenly forced to abstain, then they have no thing to hold over their heads anymore. And perhaps all those people will stand up finally and become a political force.
Well, people are standing up. And, you know, we've won 17 out of 19 statewide voter initiatives since 1996. We've never lost a medical marijuana vote. I think we'll keep seeing that kind of record continue. Higher and higher percentage of people thinks the drug war will never work, can never work. Only a small percentage, about 15%, thinks the drug war can work, and that's about the same percentage that thinks that Elvis Presley's alive. So it's a tiny, shrinking minority.
Right.
And so I think the public is starting to say no. And we already, and Bob Barr got knocked out of his Georgia congressional race.
Amen.
In part because of the stand of the drug war. So I think politicians will start feeling the brunt of their drug war support, because the public is, I think, realizing it doesn't work. It does more harm than good.
If I may interrupt, through various newspapers and organizations, they put polls on the internet, asking people whether they're for medical marijuana or adult use, etc. And the numbers have always ran 60, 70, maybe occasionally 80%. I've seen them lately 70, 80, and even into the 90s because of what the government is doing. People are standing up more against these barbaric actions that they do. John, I want to thank you. We do have another caller. Jeff has been online for a while, and I want to ask the listeners out there to please call 713-526-5738. Hello, Jeff?
Yeah.
Hi, Jeff. I hear you have a comment.
Well, I'm kind of going along with the same theme, but it's one thing to say, well, Ashcroft's out of touch, and, the DEA guys are out of touch, and, they're just doing their thing. But the big business that the drug war is, and of course, it's build more jails, buy more police cars, and of course there's the confiscation stuff, all that stuff, I don't know that they're doing that as much, but the other thing is, even the defense lawyer that gets your kid off for a stupid possession charge or something, it's gravy train. I mean, is gravy train for a big section? That's easy money. Look at how many court cases are just petty drug laws. That, they're junk cases and all that, but it's easy money for lawyers and the clerks and all that. It's part of business. So even the people that are defending you or your kid on a drug case, they're making a living from your misery, or from a drug user's misery. It's a gravy train, kind of like other wars. It's like being against Lockheed Martin or something. Close that air base, get tough on drugs, but we can build a new jail.
That's the problem. We run an advertising campaign that goes in 8 different magazines, and one of our last 2 ads was just on that question, who profits from the drug war? And if you want to see it, you can go to our website, which is our initials of our organization, Common Sense Drug Policy. It's www.csdp.org/ads/. Or just go to csdp.org and you'll look at on the public information campaign, and you'll see one of our last ads was exactly that point. That we are, really, there's a drug war industrial complex out there, from the coercive treatment industry to the drug testing industry, the pharmaceutical companies, to the big one, the prison industrial complex.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, if you need to stir up some business, if you need to stir up some customers, you can always do it. It's not like you have to wait for a crime to be committed. It's just how deep do you want to dig? Let's find some drug users, and you don't have to look very far.
Just use sheetrock.
Yeah,
like you're in Dallas, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Let's just bust illegal Latins for sheetrock.
Right.
There
must be countless, well, maybe some, legislative folks that would like to go along with it, but it's suicide the way things are. There are so few politicos, that are actually in office that have the huevos to actually do something or actually vote for. It's amazing. Santa Cruz, city council and stuff like that, that's amazing. But as far as your a lot of other, much less national
The only way that's going to change is if people like you contact your legislators and tell them you're going to vote for candidates who oppose the drug war.
Yeah.
That's where this issue has gotten to now. It's gotten to be much a very political issue. It's coming down to electing our friends and unelecting our enemies. And every politician needs to know that they vote for the drug war, they lose a vote. And that's what they got to know. And they've got to start to pay a political price for their extremism.
That's true.
Up until recently, politicians have felt that taking a position against the drug war
exactly
was political suicide.
Exactly.
Bob Barr found out that taking a too strong a position for it hurt him. And hopefully more politicians are going to see that.
Okay, now where's Bob Barr?
In Georgia.
He was in Georgia. He was a drug war leader. He was a drug war leader in Congress, and he lost his seat in part because of the drug war.
Okay. All right. Why don't you get off now?
Thank you, Jeff. We appreciate the call.
Okay.
I want to alert the listeners out there again. We are speaking with Kevin Zeese and of Common Sense for Drug Policy, Professor David Duncan of Brown University. Kevin, if you want to bail, I'll understand. I do have a series of questions I prepared for David. I figured you were going to be here about a half hour.
That'd be great. I appreciate that. It's a little bit late on the East Coast here.
I understand.
I know David's one of the top medical folks, pharmacologists in the country, so you got a good guest there. You know, I'm sure he'll be saying some useful stuff for your audience, and I'm sure he can handle this quite well without me.
Well, thank you, Kevin, and we'll have to do this again soon, buddy. You know that.
I'm sure he will. All right. Yeah, good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The war that they wage on drugs, that they wage on marijuana, as a consequence, the most beautiful flowers of our bouquet of rights have been destroyed by law enforcement.
That was
George Bush, John Ashcroft, Jerry Falwell, and Rush Limbaugh. Say, do some of these things make you nauseous? I bet they do, and have I got the cure for you. The Other Side's local talk show where the callers are the co-hosts. We cover all local, state, and national issues from a progressive perspective. In a crazy conservative country, The Other Side, your soapbox of sanity. Heard every other Friday at midnight here on KPFT 90.1, listener sponsored radio, hosted by Glenn Urbach, produced by Stacey Davis.
All right. The first speaker you heard was Tony Serra, the great San Francisco attorney, speaking earlier this spring. David, I first became aware of your work, of you know, who you are and what you do, and I want you to tell us a little bit more about that. But one of the things I see here is the ADHD, the Ritalin prescribed for literally, I guess, millions of our children because the teacher doesn't want to be disturbed by, normal behaviors. Could you talk to us about that aspect?
Well, I guess that Ritalin is one of those issues that's a very complex one, in that our problem is that we probably got a lot of kids who ought to be on it that aren't, and we got a whole lot more kids who are on it who shouldn't be. Ritalin is very effective in dealing with real attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which is a very real disorder, which really is a seriously handicapping situation. And the kids who have that problem are much better off on Ritalin. Unfortunately, most of the Ritalin is not being prescribed by psychiatrists who are competent to diagnose the situation, but by pediatricians, and often practically prescribed by the school teacher, since you got a lot of kids on it who are kids that are normal, just active kids. And whose behavior often is actually made worse by the drug. So it's a situation that is really, I think, a really serious problem, and a problem that is rooted in not enough understanding of what the real condition is, what the real treatment is. A kid who does have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is not going to learn in school, is going to be pretty miserable, and going to make those around them miserable, and is going to feel better and do better once they're on the dosage of Ritalin, which Ritalin or something like it is the most effective treatment by far for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But there just isn't as much attention deficit hyperactivity disorder as there are kids being given the medication. We got schools where half the kids in some classrooms have it. And I would be amazed to find very many cases where there were two kids with ADHD in the same classroom.
I liked one line, one of the emails you sent to ARO, and this is a quote from you: "The most common cause of such inattentiveness and distractibility, in my personal opinion, is an incompetent and boring teacher."
Yes.
I know there were many who caused me to fidget in my seat back when, because they just didn't seem to be relaying enough data to catch your attention. The government data, it's massaged, isn't it? It's twisted and turned on its head. It's pushed through various sieves to extract whatever result they want. I've seen many of your observations on that point as well. Could you talk on that issue?
Well, certainly when you start hearing the results of studies coming out of the feds, you're likely to hear only the parts of what was found that fit their purposes. And you can have a study that 90% of the findings are in one direction, and that 10% of it supports them, and it's only that 10% you'll hear about. You can have, some stuff, for instance, on cognitive dysfunction with marijuana. You have studies that show very tiny differences on a few measures and no differences at all on a vast number of measures. Well, of course, they report only about the ones that there were tiny differences on, and they neglect to mention that the differences were tiny, so that suddenly it becomes marijuana causes brain damage. But nobody who actually read the research publication would feel that any such conclusion was justified. The scientists doing the research certainly don't interpret their findings in that way. But what you get filtered through the government and published in the newspapers very often is a vast misrepresentation of what was really found in the scientific report.
I saw some data that was put together. This was actually in Great Britain, but they talked about that it was a two-point thing. One is that up to 50% of the youth in Great Britain use marijuana. The second was they were alarmed at the fact that up to 50% of the youth being admitted for treatment used marijuana. Now, you know, it's one thing to, you know, focus on the harm, as you say, when it suits your purpose, and another to avoid it when it doesn't. And there was no, you know, as far as I could tell, correlation. That it was just kids being caught with marijuana being forced to treatment.
You're right, right. A while back, I heard a spokesman from the DEA at a conference make the point that the proof that marijuana caused criminality came from some figures he had from the District of Columbia on juveniles who were brought into the juvenile detention home and how many of them tested positive for marijuana. And I compared that to the data on the schools in D.C., the percentage of students who reported marijuana use, and it seemed to me that it suggested that the rate of marijuana use in kids who were getting into trouble with the law was actually a little bit lower than that among the school students. All they were reporting was, if you take the kids who are getting in trouble out of a population, a majority of whom are experimenting with marijuana, then a majority of the kids who get in trouble are probably also going to be experimenting with marijuana. Big deal.
Yes, there's a doctor here at one of the treatment centers. Actually did a quote for, to support a march that we were doing that basically said there are many people who would be better off smoking marijuana than being addicted to, as drinkers. And he did say, but for many people, they should be doing neither. But at least he had the wherewithal to say it out loud for the television cameras that marijuana, in many cases, is a better alternative for alcoholics.
If an alcoholic can switch to marijuana instead of alcohol, he'll certainly have made a switch in the right direction. If marijuana caused all of the harm that marginally it could, it would still be a much safer drug than alcohol.
Yes. Now, I look at these studies of DON, the Drug Abuse Warning Network. You had indicated that, you know, these trauma centers, again, this is where they select the data of, you know, someone comes in and they've used marijuana in the past 30 days, that it winds up on the cheat sheet, I guess, as a tick for marijuana use causing the emergency. Whereas, you know, the truth of the matter is they may have had alcohol that night that caused the wreck that brought them there.
Right. In theory, only drugs that are related to the situation are supposed to be included. But there's no evaluation in that if somebody had an accident and they had been drinking alcohol, they'd been taking downers, and they'd been smoking marijuana, and the physician thought all three of those might have contributed some part. The fact that it was maybe alcohol and the downers 99% and marijuana 1% in his judgment, still all three would be checked off. And John Walters, in quoting it, would only mention that there were so many cases in which marijuana was mentioned, without saying that most of those cases, something else was mentioned along with it.
Right. Now, David, if you will, I'm kind of going about this interview backwards tonight. Will you tell us what your occupation is, what you do for a living, sir?
I'm primarily an epidemiologist. Which means that I study the ways in which problems are distributed in the population in order to try to understand what causes problems and how they can best be controlled. And I have for many years now specialized in using epidemiologic methods to look at problems of drug abuse and alcohol abuse, tobacco abuse, use of all of the drugs. I'm on the faculty as a clinical associate professor at Brown University. I primarily teach online courses for continuing education for professionals in the drug abuse field for Brown. I do research on various projects of my own, and I do consulting work, working for various government agencies, private organizations, etc., that need expertise in my field or in the statistical analysis of data. I also chair the Council on Illicit Drugs, which is part of the National Association for Public Health Policy, an activist group that is an offshoot of the American Public Health Association, and that represents much of the leadership of the field of public health in America.
David, could you tell the listeners where they might you know, get more information on the net that you would want to share with them?
They can come to my website, which is at www.davidfduncan.info, and there are links from that to a number of sources. We are right now setting up a website for the Council on Illicit Drugs. We hired a web designer who didn't turn up for us, so at the moment there's nothing much on that site. But in the near future, they'll be able to come to www.illicitdrugs.org and find out information about the Council on Illicit Drugs online.
Okay. Now, you know, Aza and John Walters are out trying to scare people again. They're trying to speak of, you know, harms, addiction, gateway, etc. for marijuana. And one of your emails that I got through the ARO was talking about the LD50. And tell us, what is the LD50 for a human for marijuana?
The LD50 for marijuana, essentially to give somebody enough marijuana to kill them, would involve eating several pounds of marijuana. Or consuming, I think it would be about 7 ounces of hashish. For all practical purposes, it's something that almost couldn't happen. I suppose somebody who was, you know, the police were knocking at the door, and the only way they could think of to get rid of a big bunch of hashish or a big bottle of hash oil was to consume it themselves. You might get somebody poisoned that way, but as far as I know, it's never happened. And it would have to be oral because you can't smoke enough marijuana to produce toxic effects, because one of the earliest effects you get long before you get anywhere near that is you fall asleep. So nobody could ever poison themselves by smoking marijuana. But in theory, they could poison themselves by consuming a large amount of hashish or hash oil.
Well, David, I think if I recall, as far as smoking it, I believe Judge Francis Young in that report said something like 1,500 pounds in 15 minutes if you were going to smoke it, which is, geez, a telephone pole, I guess.
Right, right. You couldn't smoke it that fast. The only way you could hope to get in that much would be to, you know, be in a room where bales of it were being burned around you. Because smoking gets so little of the THC actually into you. It's a very inefficient way of using the drug. It's only so popular because it's a very good way of titrating the drug dose, which is why many of these issues about how strong marijuana is or so forth are irrelevant, because you consume it in very tiny amounts, get very quick effects by smoking, and as a result, you determine how much intoxication you're going to have, and you stop.
Well,
you reach the level you want.
I was lucky enough, if you will, to see a demonstration by Dr. Todd Micaria out in California.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his vaporizer, very high-tech vaporizer, I guess it was. But it proved the point with a good quality of marijuana. One hit is all that is needed. There is no smoke. There is no damage to the lungs. And it totally, you know, knocks out of the water the DEA and their, you know, demonizing smoke, because it can be circumvented.
Right. With the vaporizer, you eliminate the hazards that are associated with smoking, which for all practical purposes, if somebody was just smoking marijuana, the amount of smoking they would do in order to get stoned a couple of times a day wouldn't expose them to enough to have any real health consequences. But, of course, most marijuana users are also tobacco smokers, so they're just adding to it. But the big problem is the tobacco, not the marijuana.
I agree. David, are there any points you would like to make? We're going to have to wrap up here in just a couple of minutes. Hey, there's something you'd like to relay to the listeners. What can they do to help bring rational thought to this drug war?
I think that the most important thing they can do is talk to their friends about the drug war. I think there are a lot more people out there who share our views than you're aware of. And there are an awful lot of people out there whose attitude is, the drug war isn't working, but what's the alternative? And they need to be presented with the fact that there are alternatives. That the alternative to the war on drugs is regulation, not necessarily a free market. It isn't surrender to the drug lords. It's put the drug lords out of business.
Exactly.
And the more people you talk to about that, the better. The other is getting involved in organizations. If you're in the public health field, in our organization, the Council on Illicit Drugs, for many other people, there are many good organizations such as Common Sense for Drug Policy, which I'm a member of, that are well worth your support and that are working out there actively. If you go to their website, www.csdp.org, you'll find links there also to many other organizations in the field that can focus on specific interests. If medical marijuana is your interest, if reducing the mandatory minimums is your interest, the groups that specialize on those things, get active.
David, it's a real treat to have you with us, and again, I hope to have you back in the future. I respect you for staying up so late, and I do thank you, sir.
I'm very happy to be of help.
Okay, I have a closing comment here. Diffused responsibility. That's the heart of the matter these days. That's what is helping to keep the drug war going. David was just talking that. Fear enters the picture, of course, but the truth is so evident these days. Governments all over the world are moving towards harm reduction, towards ending the drug war on their own people, except in the U.S. We see the same data. We have access to the truth, just like these other countries, but we waver and we stall and we continue to inflict monstrous harms on our own society. The drug warrior class will fight forevermore to continue the profiteering that puts food on their table. The fear of arrest, prison, vilification, and death by police officer is ever present. But the biggest stumbling block we have now is diffused responsibility. So you say, what the hell is diffused responsibility? Ever seen a car wreck just in front of you? Especially if traffic is congested, people will slow down to see what happened. Perhaps the driver is getting out with blood running down his face. The passengers are moving around as well, opening doors and yelling at each other. What do you do? What do most of us do? We look closely, thinking how that driver, well, he'll be okay. The passengers are yelling, oh, hell, they're okay. We take a last glance and we put the pedal to the metal. Now that's diffused responsibility. Taking the risk that the other guy we'll get through it, that he'll be all right. It's none of our business that it might become a hassle if we stop. Surely someone will have pity. It's saying the wreck is about them and them alone. It's part of their life. That's what the drug war has become. Thank God it's not my kid on the cops TV show. It's not my daughter whoring for crack or my son dealing heroin for profit. It's not my mother or my grandson growing pot for the sick and dying. Diffused responsibility can lead to insanity, criminality, and death. Please, no more turning away.
I'm not turning away from the pain and the trouble and the words they say which we won't understand. Don't accept that what's happening is just a case of all the suffering. Or you'll find that you're joined.